Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Lots of things are happening in Chapel Hill today, but what folks in Chapel Hill don't always realize is a lot of what is more important to them, even than what's happening in Chapel Hill at the local level on the campus or at the county commission or at the city council, are some of the things that are going on at the General Assembly, like, for instance, the UNC Chapel Hill and the UNC General Administration budget, salaries for faculty members, salaries for public school teachers, salaries for other state employees. Legislature's got all kinds of other things that might have some kind of impact on us. The proposal to restrict cities and towns from annexing involuntarily during the next few months might be something coming up about more about the UNC airport. There are all kinds of things always at the General Assembly that affect the university. And there are things that affect us as citizens of the state of North Carolina. Now, the person who watches it the most closely has agreed to spend a little bit of time with us today. And Scott Mooneyhan is... Scott, are you now the senior on-site Capitol reporter?
I'm pretty close to it. Barry Smith, who works for Freedom Newspapers, has been around here as long as I have.
Scott, your regular reports 3 times a week go out to newspapers all across the state, and you're also supervising the production of what we call the Insider, which is really an inside set of news that goes out by email to subscribers every weekday during the every weekday to report about what's happening in state government and what meetings are going to be held. So you got your fingers in the pulse sort of these days 24 hours a day.
Yeah, well, pretty much anyway. Some days maybe more than others.
Well, we're in the middle of the time of year in which the budget should have been done because the July 1st is sort of the beginning of the new fiscal year. And I guess in the year of the short session, the budget that controlled the budget that was adopted in the regular session keeps on controlling, I guess, unless there's legislative action. But it's time for a new budget. How close are we to having a new budget, and where do things stand?
I think they're fairly close. They're still arguing about some education items, and there's some argument. And this is the House and the Senate. They both have their two versions of the budget, and negotiators from each side have been meeting now for, I guess, about a week and a half, and they've worked out most of their differences, but there are some remaining differences on some education items. And also, as always, they love to fight about some of the capital projects, because that's a lot of those are kind of, it gets into the turf of the individual legislators, and they want some of that construction projects built in their districts. So,
can you illustrate it? Can you give us some illustrations?
You know, specifically, there are several. The differences are there. Most of it has to do with university construction and prison construction. And you know, I mean, they're not talking about their specific areas of disagreement right now. But I think when you consider, you know, if they're 5 prison projects and in one budget and 5 in another, and there are some overlap there, but there are a couple of differences. It's not that big a surprise when if one of those projects is in the district of, say, a powerful House member, that they're going to want that project in the final budget and not the other. And the same can be said with the university projects, and when you look at the who the people who control the budget process on each side, if they're in the House, you have folks from Durham and Greensboro, and they want to see their areas benefit from the budget. So.
When I see you're just talking all around, and you won't name names. And it's harder for us to grasp that kind of from afar. But you're saying that since Representative Shaw from Durham,
that's right,
is sort of the chief budget negotiator, one of the head co-chairs of the House Budget Committee, and he will be talking with I guess the chief budget negotiator in the Senate is with Kay Hagan campaigning. Who's the
Linda Garrew?
Linda Garrew from Winston-Salem would be.
That's right, and also Tony Rand, who's the majority leader, is always very key in the budget negotiations. Who's from Fayetteville? And you know, and Mickey Mashaw has always been a champion of North Carolina Central University. I don't know for a fact that there's any big hang up related to Central right now, but that he is, you know, certainly that is something he has always looked out for, and I'm sure is looking out for in this budget process too.
Well, Representative Mashaw has always looked out for North Carolina Central, and maybe he wouldn't have the reputation of looking out for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, like, say, Tony Rand would be. And does that explain, or can you explain the difference in treatment that the House proposed and that Representative Mashaw is arguing for, and that of the Senate that Tony Rand and Linda Garrew would be arguing for?
Well, I don't think, unless you're in those rooms, I don't think that you would know specifically, you know, where the projects are. What specifically would be the hang-ups.
Let me just mention...
As you say, I mean, Tony Rand is a graduate of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's always, really tried to help them in getting buildings built and in whatever other ways to help the university.
Well, Scott, help me with this if you can, and that is, it was my understanding that moving away from capital projects, but just concentrating on the budget, that there was a wide disparity in the budgets adopted by each of the houses, that the House budget, for instance, didn't provide as much of funds for enrollment growth, for instance,
as the Senate provided, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the Senate provided, I believe, more than 30 million more. Now, here's one of the things that people haven't discussed. You know, last year, they made the university enrollment a recurring item in the budget. And what that means is that now it's a part of the continuation budget. You don't see that number. The university, the folks who run the general administration in Chapel Hill, they want some money. This is money above and beyond that recurring money for university enrollment. What they're saying now is, look, we wanted this money in the budget every year, but in fact, we need some money in excess of that money this year. We're having more enrollment than even we expected last year when we came to you. So it's the House's position. Hey, look, you wanted this money recurring. We gave it to you recurring, and now you're back for more. You know, this is the best we can do, and I think it's $17 or $18 million is the House's position, and the Senate really would like to do more for the university system.
Anything else specifically where the university system is in the middle between the budget negotiators?
That's the only thing I'm aware of. Now, I think the flip side of that, though, is that the House provided more money for the local school systems to pay for the diesel fuel for the buses. And so, you know, what they're coming back saying to the Senate is, hey, we have to have this money. It's, you know, we don't have any control over the price of gasoline, and this is just an expense that we can't, if we don't fund it, we're going to be having to come up with some type of emergency.
But so their argument is that this is not an increase in services. This is just a necessary increase to fund the level of services that you contemplated when you adopted the original budget.
That's right.
Now, but so the House is providing for fuel for the school buses, and the Senate is providing for enrollment growth at the universities, and somehow or another they got to work that out.
That's correct.
What else is as far as you can tell up in the air among the that's keeping the budget negotiators from coming to an agreement?
I think those are the two main things. I mean those issues related to education and the capital projects. And you know they can fight for days or weeks about some of these construction projects and these are often the things that do hang them up.
Would you say that, are they fighting about pork? Is that what they're doing?
Well, I think that's certainly the most egregious kind of pork, but it's certainly they're fighting about it because for the same reasons that they've thought about the more egregious pork in years past. And, you know, for your listeners, the last few years with all some of the scandals up here, they have really cut back on a lot of these little $100,000 projects here that really benefit real small groups of people. So instead, what you have are these major projects like university construction and no
pork except big pork for the big chairs.
That's right.
You're supposed to say no. That's not
no,
right.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's for a lot of people, but it is big pork. I mean, it is big. It's the big stuff. And I don't know. Maybe that makes it harder to come to grips. Well, maybe it makes it easier. I don't know. You know, once upon a time, and I know you know this, they used to actually have pork bills where they would go through and. That was kind of how you kept the legislators in line for voting for the budget. You'd do those who voted for the budget, and then you'd follow up with a...
Got $2,500 for your fire station
That's
or something
right.
like that.
That's what
you Scott, we probably need to take a break right now. Let me. Jeff Hamlin's helping me today, but he's got to give me the signal. So we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Scott Mooneyham. We'll be back after this short break to continue our discussion about the status of things in Raleigh. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking with Scott Mooneyham, the senior, I still say the most senior political reporter in Raleigh, covering and writing for statewide events. And Scott, you've helped us begin to understand the status of budget negotiations in Raleigh and the impact of those discussions on those of us who live in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Orange County. I think one of the, you know, it came to me during the break, Scott, that Chapel Hill is interested in the treatment of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the other parts of the university system, but so many parts of the state that aren't blessed with having a university to drive the economy in their area, they're really fighting for the prisons. If somebody argued for a prison in Orange County, I think you'd start a riot, wouldn't you?
Oh, I'm sure you're right, but yeah, in rural parts of the state, prisons are economic development. They bring jobs, and they're still seen that way. I don't think you'll place like Scotland County, I don't think you'll hear too many people complaining.
In fact, it's just the opposite. You'll be expecting your legislator to work really hard to bring whatever is brought to bear. I guess you could argue that the universities and the prisons together take care of the upbringing of as many as possible of the young men and women for the state of North Carolina.
Kind of a sad
keep them off
way
the streets. Well, let's talk about more serious things, if I can. Just some things that have, and maybe you can help me with them. But one of the things that seems to be on the table right now in Raleigh is a proposal to have a fairly long moratorium on involuntary annexations. And what? Where does that stand? Is that going anywhere? And what's the genesis of it? And what would the proposed legislation do?
Well, first, what it would do, it would the legislation as it stands right now would stop involuntary annexations for 9 months. Originally, it was longer, and there were some other provisions in the bill that would also prevent cities and towns from even conducting some of the processes that might lead to annexation. at this point, some of those provisions have been taken out of the bill, so the cities could still do a lot of
lead-up
activities, mm-hmm. but they just, from July 31st until April 30th, they just would not be able to actually annex any territory without the full consent of the people to be annexed. You know, in terms of where this came from, there's been a lot of complaints about North Carolina's annexation laws. A lot of it comes from people who have moved into this state from other states where the annexation laws are not liberal is the term, or certainly as
heavy-handed, maybe they would say.
They would certainly say that, you're right. And so the legislature, the House in particular, began holding public hearings on this issue, I think maybe a couple of years back. And you know, some people would come in, and the big complaint is that some people are annexed and they're not really given the full range of city services for many years, till many years later. I don't know. The way I look at this, I don't think the bill's going anywhere in the Senate. I think this is a way to placate the people who have been complaining. There are some House Democrats who do think this is the proper thing to do, but I also think it gives them some political cover. I'm just surprised I'm not hearing more from the League of Municipalities and the mayors and folks like that. I think they'd be up here in full force if they really thought that this thing was going to pass both chambers. So.
The accepted wisdom among North Carolina public servants, particularly municipal leaders, is that this, as you call it, liberal or heavy-handed annexation authority that allows cities to bring in communities that are ripe for urbanization has given North Carolina advantage over other states in terms of having healthy municipalities and not having so much divisiveness like you find in some of the other states where the larger municipalities particularly are just hemmed in by and not able to annex and grow.
And I think if you go ride through Richmond or go ride through Pittsburgh, I think you'll probably see that that is indeed the case.
So is that you think under the legislature just sort of is pandering now, but not doing anything substantive in this regard?
Those are my words.
You don't have to agree
with
me.
Well, that's how I see it. And that doesn't mean they won't, particularly the House, won't come back with some more serious legislation next year to actually attempt to, maybe deal with some of the excesses here. Maybe make sure that cities are actually providing services in a more timely fashion. But my question would be, why not do that now? I don't think that's if that's really their intent. I don't think it's such a huge policy issue that you have to. Let's study it for 12 more months or something.
Let's talk about something more exciting.
Okay.
What else should people in Chapel Hill know about pending legislation, about arguments in the legislature? Are we at risk of anything happening to us that we're going to wake up when the legislature's gone and you're going to say, well, you should ask about that.
Well, I'm writing about something right now that they may be able to, they may find that ticket scalping in some respects is legal in North Carolina. Before long, there's some legislation that would actually allow internet resales of tickets at any price. Of course, that's happening now because North Carolina's law is, I guess, unenforceable, and I think that's the intent behind the legislation.
Well, what I'm interested, but you're not talking about what I'm interested in when I go out there and try to resell my tickets for a little bit more than the face value next basketball season when things are going to be hot
I think you still might get arrested, DJ.
Well, I'll have to continue to conceal my activities.
Yeah, maybe that's inequitable treatment under the law, you know.
That you're going to let, I mean, the internet is really preferred. Everything from no sales taxes on orders and all of this stuff, and now they're going to let people who can afford to get on the internet and set up a website and all that sell those tickets without fear of being prosecuted. And me and Jeff, when we try to sell our tickets out there in front of the ding-dong, we're still going to jail.
In trouble.
Can they do that at Appalachian State for the football tickets when they beat LSU this year?
Jeff has he tilts mountain wise when it comes to football, particularly.
Right. Yeah, it's more than a tilt, by the way. But go ahead.
that's interesting, and I didn't know about that. Anything else going on?
Well, that's all I know about. Well, other than the topic I think you're broaching. So.
Well, let me. I'm real interested. I understand there's a press conference, and my question for you, Scott Minahan, you cover state politics, and go where other people won't go to get your stories. And why didn't you go to Estonia to cover the first lady's trip?
And well, I wasn't invited, and my bosses wouldn't pay for it. But
it would only be $50,000 or $60,000, I think, for you to go. Many of us read the story in the News and Observer about the trips to Paris and to Estonia. Earlier, you had written a story about the governor's and first lady's trip to Italy, which was also quite expensive. Those of us in the local area followed the travels of a Wake County, I guess, official all over the country visiting recycling parks or something. He was able to get quite a bill. Is this just something that people are stirring up because there's nothing else to worry about, or is this really substantive?
Well, I think it certainly gets people stirred up. When you look at these kinds of stories, I think that it's one of those things people really understand. It's very much a story that. This is people's money there, and so when the average taxpayer sees a public official traveling and on a lavish trip and something that they can't do, I think it certainly taps that anger. So.
Well, you know what my theory about all this is, and that is that this is a evil plot by Governor Easley. And he got so mad with everybody complaining for almost 8 years that he never did anything, never went anywhere, never would go anywhere, but hit out, but would go to Southport and go fishing and go into the basement of the mansion and work on his woodworking projects and never would do anything. That what he decided to do is that he would go to Italy and spend a lot of money, and the News and Observer would write an article about it, and they would complain about him going and spending so much money that for the rest of the term he could just say, I'm not going anywhere because y'all criticize me every time I take a trip.
Yeah, but he didn't go with Mary to France or to Russia and Estonia, though.
Well, he just said he'd do it that the one time, and that would be enough. And that Mary, since it didn't work out maybe to get enough criticism, he'd get Mary to do it, but that was enough. He wasn't going.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it a big deal? Is it a big deal, or is this just something to pass over?
Well, I think the thing is, he's a lame duck governor. I don't think he'll run for any political offices in this state again. So in that regard, I don't think it harms his political career.
Listen, let's take a quick break, and we'll talk about this some more. I'm real interested in your thoughts about this. I'm talking to Scott Minahan. We're talking about what's going on in Raleigh and how what's going on in Raleigh might have an impact on those of us who live over here in Orange County. Scott Minahan and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest from over in Raleigh is Scott Minahan, a capital area reporter writing for newspapers across the state, and generously sharing his time with those of us who live over here in Orange County, telling us about some of the things that are happening in Raleigh these days that are of interest or have a strong impact on the way we live here in Orange County. But, Scott, we were talking before the break, we were talking about the recent exposés of the governor's and the first lady's expensive traveling recently. You had helped blow the whistle on the governor recently and on his trip to Italy, and you, all of us, I guess, were treated to the expensive trips to Estonia, Russia, and Paris recently by Mrs. Easley. I guess the question I've got is, and it's also the other interesting story that you kind of laughed at was this story about the woman the woman in a high place in the mental health system who had her portrait painted with public funds, maybe not actually tax dollars, but they were nevertheless public funds. And my question is the culture of public service changing a little bit so that North Carolina, which has always been the good government state where you pour yourself into public service and don't really look for anything for yourself as a state official, is that kind of been washed away, or are we hearing about these things because they're just exceptions to the general rule that state employees and state officials generally still serve the public good?
Well, you know, I don't know. I do know that as long as I've been in this business, there have been stories like this, and I mean, I remember writing many myself, and maybe not to the degree that some of these are, but, you know, I mean, certainly where public officials go off on trips, and there's always some question about, you know, how much of that is the legitimacy of travel when it involves exotic places and a lot of expense. I don't know. I mean, I suppose that some of this is reflective of society in general, maybe, and if that's so, I guess that's sad. I don't want to sound self-righteous, but frankly, I can't imagine being in a position where I would use public money to have a portrait painted of me.
That would be. Here's the thing. I'm trying to remember my days as a public official, and I did some stupid things. But thank goodness I was surrounded by people who usually took care of me. This is just reminiscent, but when I first came, I was sort of in charge of the Board of Governors, of running the Board of Governors meetings. And it was a year where there were some budget restrictions. And so the Board of Governors, you know, had an annual retreat where tried to get, you know, in an informal way, tried to tackle some of the tough issues informally. And in this year, it was there just wasn't enough money to go anywhere. And so we got a good deal with a local hotel in the near the Research Triangle, real good deal. And I thought, golly, well, we got to make this fun for these guys. How are we going to do it? So the hotel had a little pond in, you know, right next to the hotel, and I said, well, we'll just have a regatta. They've got some paddle boats. We'll have a regatta for them. And so we sent a note out that we were going to have a regatta. Well, we were covered up with newspaper reporters who wrote stories about how we were wasting the public money I think we spent $50 to rent the boats or something like that. And I learned my lesson that you just better be careful. You just better be careful about these things, because you guys are ready to spring if you find out about it.
Yeah.
But what else is going on over there that we don't even know about, and how are we going to find out?
Well, I'm sure somebody will do some digging, assuming the newspaper business continues on.
Well, let's move to a different topic, maybe one that's more exciting. We have a gubernatorial candidate who lives a lot of the times with her husband here in Chapel Hill, Beverly Perdue, and there is an attractive candidate on the other side, the mayor of Charlotte. Do people in Raleigh talk about that race, or are they so involved in current government activities and running the legislature and getting the budget adopted that they don't talk about it very much?
No, they talk about it a lot.
What are they saying?
A lot of interest. I think there's a feeling that McCrory is a very strong candidate, and nonetheless, you know, the landscape is tilted to the Democrats this year, and so the question becomes, will his strengths as a candidate be able to overcome any of that? And certainly, Lieutenant Governor Perdue, you know, I mean, she is such a credentialed candidate herself, and she has kind of made all the right moves within the party apparatus, as it or party organization, and
so the bets are still on her over there.
I think the bets are still on her.
Let me ask.
A recognition, probably. You know, he's probably the strongest Republican candidate though since Jim Martin.
That's interesting. He's attractive and vibrant, and he seems to have a genuine, easy smile on his face
all
the
right.
time, and is able to toss off some of these barbs that people have without getting seemingly angry all the time. I think that's an attractive part of his candidacy. But something happened just the other day that surprised me, and I bet you know more about it than I do and can explain it to me. But why in the world would he, and as a matter of fact, the other Republican candidates in coastal areas all of a sudden be changing their positions on the protection of the coastal areas from offshore drilling? What's the word over there about that? Why did he do that?
I have no idea. I mean, and I really haven't heard any. I don't know if they've looked at polling data that suggests that now that with the high gasoline prices that people are more willing to consider that. But I think that I'm not convinced that it's a wise move, because the more it's discussed and I think people are going to see that it's really not much of a long-term solution to any problem.
So you think it'll hurt him in North Carolina, North Carolina?
I think it could potentially hurt him. I don't think it's any accident that historically political candidates have taken a very dim view of oil drilling off the North Carolina coast. And I just tend to think that people are not that the people of this state are not that enamored of the idea. But it wouldn't surprise me at all that they have seen some polling data that maybe shakes that up a little bit. But again, you know, polls have a way of changing.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's a matter of – I don't think it's an act of conscience or courage. I don't think it's a courageous decision. I think it's something that had to be backed up by the polls, and it's something that neither you nor I have figured out where that polling came from. And that's something we can talk about maybe a month or two later when these things shake out. We're going to – Scott, can you stay with us? We need to take just a quick break, and then I've got just a couple more questions I need to ask you. I'm talking to Scott Mooneyham. Manages The Insider, writes political newspaper columns for papers across the state, and has given us the inside poop in Raleigh, and he'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking to Scott Mooneyham, great newspaper columnist and leader of the Insider Report over in Raleigh. Cheerfully sharing his time with us. Maybe is it more fun to talk to us than to do your job over there in
Absolutely.
Raleigh? Now, thank you for doing this. We're talking about the governor's race and the puzzle that you and I feel that Pat McCrory, who is seeming to maybe get a little bit of traction, decided to support presidential candidate McCain's idea of letting the states decide whether or not offshore drilling is a good thing. And Pat McCrory apparently says he thinks that's a good idea, and that it would be a good idea for North Carolina jobs-wise and income-wise and otherwise to open our offshore to oil drilling. And still can't figure it out, but Scott, I mean, clearly there's something that the Republican strategists know that you and I haven't found out yet, that we're going to find out soon, that there is this something going on in the public that supports that idea.
Well, I think it is probably polling data that's a reflection of the gasoline prices where they are right now. But the reason I suggest it may not be a very wise move is because the issue is going to be discussed, not just in North Carolina, but it's a national issue. And as it is, talked about a lot out in the public sphere, I think people, you know, will see that there are some problems with it, and you know, and the most the most problematic is that it I'm just not at all convinced it's a real long-term solution to much of anything, because you know, there are some statistics about how many more cars are going to be on the road in China and India in 5 years, 10 years, and I'm just not sure that we can drill our way out of the energy crisis as it exists. But that's my.
We'll see what the North Carolinians think about it. We just got a minute, but can you tell us what people in Raleigh are saying about the presidential race? The Obama people seem to think that they might be able to pull it off in North Carolina if they work real hard. Others, cynics, are saying not in your lifetime is North Carolina going to vote for a Democrat for president. What are you hearing over there?
I think that Obama's people will keep on looking at North Carolina for a while and look at the polls, and they've run ads here, so they're not giving up on the state yet. I think they'll just very carefully look at it. I think it's going to be pretty difficult for them, but at the same time, even if he is within 5 points in this state of McCain, that's not good news for McCain nationally, and it's not good news for Republicans within the state of North Carolina.
Is there an optimistic feeling among Democrats that this strength of Obama, not, even if it's not a winning strength in this state, is going to help Democrats this fall rather than be a drag, as we found for Democrats in some prior presidential years?
I think that's the general feeling, is that he probably can't win the state, but that he's going to do well enough that he helps other Democrats.
Real quickly, any action on the lieutenant governor's race or the council of state? Is anybody interested in those yet?
I don't think so, but there'll be some, particularly the lieutenant governor's race will perk up as we get closer to November.
Well, Scott, this has been great. Would you be willing to update us again, as particularly if the legislative session goes on, and help us understand again what's going on over there?
Yep, call me anytime.
Thanks. Well, it's been great. Thanks to Jeff Hamlin for helping us get through it. Special thanks to Scott Mooneyham over in Raleigh for helping those of us in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Orange County understand what's going on in Raleigh and how it's impacting us. Thanks for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.